And welcome to Worlds Apart. Freshly reinaugurated, the Russian president is making his first official visit to China as the worldview contestation between these two nations and the West gets ever more pronounced. With all sides having passed their points of no return, where is history heading now? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Fyodor Lukyanov, editor-in-chief of Russia in Foreign Affairs magazine and research director of the Valdai Discussion Club. Mr. Lukyanov, it's always a great pleasure for me to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Same for me.
Now, the choice of China as the destination for Vladimir Putin's visit after renewing his term is not really surprising. And yet, I think there is some poignancy to that, given the nature of the historical moment. How is the Russian-Chinese relationship now different from, let's say, 6 years ago?
First of all, the visit is not a surprise, as you rightly said. And this is Putin's response to last year's visit of Chairman Xi Jinping to Moscow. And that was his first visit after the official inauguration as the head of state. So Putin pays the return. As for relationship compared to 6 years ago, Russia had much more diversified picture of international partners. Now, for obvious reasons, this picture has been shrinked or and shrinking.
Crystallized.
Crystallized. Not necessarily crystallized, because 6 years ago it was a much, much broader scope of international partners. How much sincere they were vis-a-vis Russia, that's another question. But in terms of economy, Russia was 6 years ago or 5 years ago or even 3 years ago integral part of international global economic system, which is not the case now because of Western actions to remove Russia from international economy. And this is the most important change. That Russia has to rely on other very important partners. And there are many, but China is by default the most important because of size, because of economic potential, and because China is the biggest neighbor.
Now, you mentioned the previous visit of President Xi to Russia, and at that time he was overheard telling Putin that the two nations, or perhaps the two leaders, are spearheading changes the likes of which the world hasn't seen in the last 100 years. And it's already been reported that on this visit, Putin is going to present Xi with a sort of historical manuscript by Russian writer Nikolai Chernyshevsky under the title of What to Do. How much history plays into what the countries decide to do in going into the future?
You know, Chernyshevsky is not the most popular writer nowadays in Russia.
But apparently he is one of the favorites of Xi.
Maybe. But this is quite an interesting distinction, interesting difference, because Chernyshevsky was part of necessary reading during the Soviet time, because Chernyshevsky was a dissident during the Tsarist Russia, and he was glorified by the Soviet literary science. Now, I wouldn't say that Russian mood, especially the mood of Russian leadership, is a revolutionary one in terms of how to organize the country. It's rather the very conservative approach to values, to means how to govern, how to organize society. And in this regard, yes, indeed, I think for China, which is still officially a communist country, ruled by the Communist Party, Chernyshevsky might be still relevant, while in Russia we are now in a different phase. As far as the history is concerned, yes and no. On the one hand, of course, any decision made by any state, any head of state, is being determined by culture, and the culture is determined by historical experience, history. In this regard, yes, of course, Putin is very much aware of Russian history, and we know that in almost any conversation he has with the Russian audience or foreign audience, like a couple of months ago with Tucker Carlson, he loves to refer to history. And this is very important because in a very turbulent and disruptive world, you need to have some kind of fundament.
But this is a very interesting point because, as you mentioned, both Russia and China, despite their political and governing conservatism, are sort of moving, proactively moving into the future. They are not afraid of the future. But when we take, for example, the United States, despite its supposedly progressivist values, if you look at the slogans of presidential campaigns, regardless of whether they come from Democrats or the Republicans, it's usually about the return to the glorious past. The United States seems to be somewhat, not somewhat, but very much apprehensive of the future. How do you explain this paradox?
You know, I'm not a big specialist on domestic situation in the United States, but I would say the current mood is even more complicated because, yes, indeed, we see and we hear many politicians in the United States referring to the glorious past, Ronald Reagan, whatever.
Well, even the Democrats build back better. How much forward you can be? How much more forward you can be?
At the same time, you know, my feeling, looking from far away, is that society in the United States, or probably establishment in the United States, they are rather very much afraid of the past. Because they change the past all the time. The new approach to history is to appropriate this, to make it compatible to principles and moral stances, moral points, as they are understood today, not historically seen. And for me, it's a very strange trend. Because you basically undermine your past in order to make the contemporary situation more governable, if I understand correctly what American politicians are doing.
Now, I think one of the biggest challenges of our times, both on individual and collective levels, is to move fast, but also at the same time to stay grounded. And this is what history allows you to do. And also to be picky about your priorities. And I think in the past, the West and the United States in particular were rather considerate and deliberate about their risks or their influence. But nowadays, they sort of move to omnipotence and omniscience at the same time, while having little grounding, as you pointed out. How do you explain that their willingness to be sort of on top of everything, while their resources are clearly not there?
Well, it's quite understandable because we live, as Chairman Xi told Putin a year ago, we live in a period of unprecedented and pretty rare changes, profound changes. It's not like cosmetic transformation, adaptation of our life. This is a profound change of how the world is functioning. It's not even geopolitics. It's not about struggle between great powers, which is stated in the U.S. National Security concept. It's just a little part of that, because in fact we see enormous changes in how society is being organized.
Absolutely, but wouldn't that necessitate to have a strategy about, you know, which battles you pick up, whether you fight with China and Russia or do something else?
This is a strategy which, from my point of view, is a substitute. When you don't know how to address real challenges, the real problems, then you need to find problems which you believe you can address. And then Russia, China, Iran,
Seems like a manageable problem to address.
More manageable than the societal ones.
I wonder if history and historical knowledge, at the end of the day, is not just a fascination of the leaders, but something that allows leaders to have grounding in how to manage their own societies.
No, absolutely. It's extremely difficult. And in this regard, the United States has its own problems. Russia is not immune from enormous challenges either. We see that on the one hand, history and tradition are absolutely indispensable to keep going, to have this ground for development. At the same time, of course, if you try to implement tradition as you understand the past for the present and the future, it will not work, because tradition should be adapted. Tradition is a setup of values, not setup of instruments how to address issues, current issues. And in this regard, each nation, each country tries to find their own setup of instruments, rather unsuccessfully yet, I would say.
Now, speaking about different instruments, you wrote recently that Moscow and Beijing are not only aligned in their worldview, but also quite distinct about how they approach their tensions with the West, at least on a tactical level. What are some of the main differences between Moscow and Beijing?
The main difference is very clear. China is not just a part of global economy, it's one of pillars of the global economy. Russia is not at this point, because Russia is struggling to not even to regain, but to keep the place which it occupies. And Russia, because of our conflict, I would say, can afford to be more flexible and more creative vis-a-vis the rules imposed by the ruling group of countries, the ruling yet.
Can or cannot?
Can. Because we have
burned
not
all
much
the stops
to lose.
And it can go
exactly, we have not much to lose anymore. They did, I mean, the West did almost everything they could in terms of economic blockade, sanctions, embargoes, and so on. China is in a completely different position. China needs a pretty smooth economic development to address domestic issues, which are big, which are huge. And in this regard, we see that on the political level, Chinese and Russian approaches are pretty similar, not completely similar, but pretty similar. But when it comes to economy, of course, China thinks about its own interests, and not about Russian interest in the first hand. And that means, in practical terms, just now, for example, and I think it will be discussed when Putin comes to Beijing, that Chinese companies, especially Chinese banks, are extremely cautious, to put it mildly, when it comes to business with Russia, because they don't want to become objects of U.S. secondary sanctions. And this is not because they dislike Russia or they don't share Russian aspiration, but they think about their own interests, which are different.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mr. Lukyanov, we have to be a little bit different at this point of time because we need to take a short break, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Fyodor Lukyanov, Editor-in-Chief of Russia in Global Affairs magazine. Mr. Lukyanov, before the break, you mentioned that the Chinese are far more cautious about how they deal with the West, and both sides pay lip service to responsibly managing their competition. But on the other hand, it's pretty visible that mutual irritation is growing. And there has been, you know, a succession of American leaders visiting China. And it's pretty clear that their reception is sometimes not what they expect to get. My question to you is, looking at the Sino-American relationship, how much of it is due to the objective nature of their differences, and how much of it is due to the communicative style that both Beijing or Washington choose to practice vis-a-vis one another?
Communicative style is important, and in this regard, I think that American style and Chinese style are two extremes, so to say. We can see collision of two completely different approaches to how international relations should be conducted. As far as the American style, American way of diplomacy is concerned, of course, it sounds and it looks a little bit strange when American high representative, be it Secretary of State or even President of the United States, meets the Chinese counterpart, and the obvious wish, the obvious agenda is to improve relationship, to stabilize relationship.
Well, the obvious for you or
the obvious even for Americans, because they say that we need to normalize, we need to stabilize. Maybe not to improve, but to stabilize. With this intention, they come, but at the same time, they start to talk, start to say to Chinese, but we want to have better relationship, but you should not do this, you should not do that, you should be aware that if you do this, we will... So it's not a very much friendly approach. Secondly, that's like a joke already, that, for example, Secretary of State has meeting with Chinese, which does more or less okay. Same day or next day, President Biden speaks somewhere and says that, yeah, President Xi is a dictator, and we know this. So it's very difficult to comprehend, actually, for
Do you think that matters for the Chinese? I mean, do they pay any attention to that, or does it affect substantive politics? Because, I mean, they may express outrage in public, but does it affect the way they deal with the Americans?
I think it does affect how they deal, but Chinese are very much different from us, for example, from Russians. They are very patient, and they accumulate. They accumulate, and they make notes. And, of course, it forms a long-term approach and a long-term agenda for China. So I think Chinese are very much aware that the middle-term perspective or long-term perspective of their relationship with the United States is a very harsh conflict. Maybe not necessarily war, but very harsh competition. They know that now. They didn't. They were not that sure, say, 5 years ago. But now they know it. But at the same time, yes, they are very keen to look as if they disregard, because yes, they really want to stabilize relationship at this point, and. Yeah, they are in a way much more sophisticated. They indicate that they notice, but they do as if they can, so to say, communicate and cooperate anyway. But again, that's a very, very visible and obvious discrepancy in approaches. Cultural approach. It's not just about diplomacy.
And there are many other countries who are watching this interaction. I think this is a new phenomenon of recent years of sort of sitting on the fence. And many countries do it in very different ways. The way, let's say, United Arab Emirates balance is very different from the way Turkey balances and many other countries. Can you talk a little bit more about this proactive form of diplomacy, of sitting on the fence, and what are the risks and the opportunities that it allows?
You know, I wouldn't call it sitting on the fence, because sitting on the fence is a passive approach. What is happening in international relations nowadays? How actors behave, and those actors are multiple. We see much more active countries, middle-sized countries, which have a real influence on the international relations, much more than before. Because years ago we had okay, a couple of countries, others were
the global majority.
The global majority was rather silent. Now the global majority is not silent anymore. The global majority says that we have our interests. They are sitting on the fence in one sense, that they don't want to join any side in competitions or wars on conflicts which they don't believe are theirs.
Okay. Now, there are many countries who don't want to be trampled under this great power rivalry, but there is one particular exception, which is Ukraine, that wants to be right in the midst of the fire. 2 years into the conflict in that country, how do you understand the current Ukrainian calculus? And has it changed in any way given the losses of the last 2 years?
I don't think the calculus changed. And more than that, I don't believe that this particular leadership can afford to change the calculus, because they made once, they put everything on one stake to win. Obviously, they cannot do it. But they created, they orchestrated the whole situation, I mean, ideologically, politically, economically, in military terms, everything, in a way which doesn't allow them to back, doesn't allow them to change the position. Because now, initial point, not even by Zelensky, by Ukrainian presidents, I would say years, if not decades ago, the initial point was that we have to break with Russia and to join another camp. That's another discussion, whether it was wise or not, or totally reckless, whatever.
Or even possible.
Or even possible, but it happened. And then during the 2000s and 2010s, that escalated all the time, and that led to the conflict which we witness now. And since this idea prevailed that the only way for Ukraine to survive is to join the West, to join formally, to formally join the West institutionally, that means that at least for this ruling group, there is no other option but to fight, whatever the price for the nation will be. So that's why you are absolutely right that Ukraine is a big exception from the global trend. The global trend is to try to maneuver and to try to even manipulate, but not to get involved.
Or to care about self-preservation for that
reason. Exactly. It's not the case with Ukraine, and unfortunately, I'm afraid that the consequences for this nation will be disastrous.
Now, the West is now organizing a conference in Switzerland to discuss the conflict in Ukraine, and Russia is not invited. And yet there is an attempt to give this event some sort of international representation and legitimacy. How do you understand the purpose? Why would the other side be motivated by something like this at this point?
You know, the purpose of organizers is absolutely clear. Two purposes. One purpose is to legitimize Vladimir Zelensky, because we know that formally he has some problem. His official term expires in May. And after that, that's a legal debate, whether he still remains the legitimate president or not. Debate not internationally, but debate domestically, which is much more important, because legitimacy is about domestic situation, not about international recognition. So the conference is an attempt by friends of Zelensky and friends of today's Kiev to demonstrate that he's still the absolutely legitimate, powerful head of state, leader of the nation. Second motivation is to demonstrate, to create an atmosphere, to create an image that everybody is for peaceful solution but Russia. And that's why participation of this world majority countries absolutely essential. That's why China is desperately being repeatedly invited by Ukrainians, by Swiss, by Americans, and so. And that's why Chinese are so far at least very, again, very cautious whether to participate in this. This is a game, actually. It's not about peace, of course.
I heard you say recently that a major obstacle to any substantive peace negotiations is that Russia and the West understand the casus belli for this conflict in very different terms. Why would that even matter at this point, given the profound changes on the ground?
That would matter at this point or at some later point, because sooner or later it should come to some kind of peace talk. Open, closed, secret, official, whatever. And the question is about what? And this is the main difference, that for the West and for Ukraine, they promote it very much. This is an imperialistic war by Putin.
Well, but that's just rhetoric. Do you think
I don't believe it's just rhetoric. I think for Ukrainians and for many in the West, this is really Putin's attempt to just gain territory, destroy a country which Russian leader and many in Russia sees as historical part of Russia and so on. And so that's about Ukraine. So negotiations should be about Ukraine. A Russian position, and I think this should be emphasized very much, that the casus belli was not Ukraine. The casus belli was expansion of NATO. Rightly, wrongly, we can discuss it, but Russia perceived expansion of NATO as a vital existential threat to Russian security. And it must be repeated once again that Russia said it many, many times since mid-1990s, actually, when NATO enlargement started. No one cared about this. No one wanted to listen. And if we believe that the whole issue is about Ukraine, it's one type of negotiations, which Russia will not be engaged in. If we believe, as Russians think, and as I share this view, that the casus belli and the issue was about NATO, which means about security in security arrangements in Europe, that's completely another type of dialogue with completely different setup of participants.
Well, Mr. Lukyanov, we have to leave it there. Thank you very much for your time. And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.